Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 23rd, 2004. Today's session number is BRM 2004-010. Today's speaker is Mark Brocker. The lesson for today is Bonhoeffer, Conspiracy and Imprisonment. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Modern Christian Martyr. Let's listen in.
My name's Mark Brocker, and our topic today is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Christian Martyr, with a question mark. This is the last of the five presentations that I'm doing. We've been really focusing on key themes and topics related to the time when Bonhoeffer was involved in a conspiracy and was imprisoned. So you're really looking at primarily at the years 1940 through 45, although we have had to refer a great deal to what went on before then, because that provides context for the various issues that we've dealt with. I had prepared this particular presentation, and I had to do more work on this one in particular, because in the past, when I taught a class down in seminary where we were going through some of these topics and had more time to deal with them, but still some of the same topics. And the translator for volume 16, the volume I've been working on, Conspiracy and Imprisonment, did the presentation on Bonhoeffer's Martyr and wrote a wonderful paper on that. And so she was the one that did it. So this time around, I needed to do that. So we're waving goodbye to the bus here. You can all wave here. So I prepared what I wanted to share with you, and then I became aware of a book, and fortunately I was able to get it on the day before I left to come to Holden. Amazon was able to get it to me, Amazon.com, called Bonhoeffer as Martyr, without a question mark. So if you want to read the book on Bonhoeffer as Martyr, and it's a very thorough book, I think it was probably part of his dissertation work, and so there's a little bit of that to it, and that can get a little bit tedious at times, but still a great book if you're really interested in this topic, not just about Bonhoeffer, but in terms of martyrdom. This would be a good book to tackle and wrestle with. Craig Swain, let me write his name up here so you have that. Craig Swain, Bonhoeffer is Martyr. Just to give you just a brief sum of his position on this, is he does come to the conclusion that Bonhoeffer was a martyr, and it's very nuanced, and he recognizes some of the differences between Bonhoeffer and the classical martyrs, which I'll be laying out for you. But he finally not only says that he's a martyr, but he views martyrdom as the key concept to interpret all of Bonhoeffer's life. That's where I would raise some questions with him, in terms of using that, as important as that is, to use that as the theme then to interpret his life. It's the kinds of thing that has tended to be the case in Bonhoeffer studies, is to take one theme or concept and make it the concept to interpret everything. Although if you were going to pick one, I can see where someone would go in this direction, because even when we described for the documentary Tuesday, we watched the documentary, and the simple description was, it's Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was hung by the Nazis for his part in the role to assassinate Adolf Hitler. So his death truly is one of the reasons why people pay attention to him, because of the way his life ended. So, but anyway, that's one a good book that's out. I've been reading through this. That's been my reading while I've been here. And I got almost to the end. I have one more chapter to go. And you might be interested that the final chapter he ends with is, he's talking about Finkenwalde, the seminary that Bonhoeffer was working with, and he calls it Training for Martyrdom. So finally, in the end, he wants to finish with this, which is striking, because those of us, obviously, that are alive now, if martyrdom is something that we might need to confront, is there kind of training that would prepare people of faith for martyrdom if necessary? So it'll be interesting to see what he says in his last chapter, but that's where he ends. He ends with the training at Finkenwalde, where Bonhoeffer was instructing these seminarians. What we'll do is I'm going to make a presentation. This one will take a little bit less time than I've tended to take for the presentations I've been making. We'll have some time for discussion, and then I do want to say maybe 10, 15 minutes at the very end for to give you an opportunity to maybe share that what you see as one of the key insights or a key thing you've learned during the week, or some question you're still struggling with that's grown out of our work here with Bonhoeffer. Terms then, though, in terms of introduction, prior to so-called Christian times, we have the example of the prophets who were, would lift up and proclaim the word of God and speak on behalf of God. And it was said, and part of the tradition was, that a prophet's witness was sealed with his death. A prophet's witness was sealed with his death. So there was a sense in which that death would confirm the prophet's witness. That was part of the tradition. In 2 Maccabees 6:18 through 7:42, and if you want to look this, you could look this up sometime, but at 2 Maccabees 6:18 through 7:42, there is a whole procession of martyrs. And so this is another time period, second century before Christ, where there was this a number of martyrs. We also have in Greek literature the death of Socrates is lifted up as the brave death of a philosopher. And in key point two in the tradition was, in the tradition of the people of Israel, the key point was that you need to suffer death because of your fidelity to the law or to Torah. Okay, so it's important why you're suffering in terms of martyrdom, would be because of your fidelity to the Torah. Now, in terms of Jesus, Jesus is lifted up as a model of one who suffered what we would, his is not called the martyr's death, it's really the example for the martyrs. But Jesus offers no defense before the powers that be. This is one trait that's often lifted up in classical understanding of martyrdom. He's obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross, from Philippians 2, that 5 through 11, what's thought to be perhaps a Christian hymn, early Christian hymn. There's the charge to the followers in Mark 8:34, take up your cross and follow me. And so Jesus' death and his suffering and his death are lifted up as a model for us. Stephen is often looked at as the first Christian martyr. And the account given of Stephen in Acts chapter 6, there's certainly some parallels to Jesus in terms of the way that Stephen finally meets his end, his fate. He fearlessly proclaims the word of God. A second thing he does is he issues a final prayer entrusting his spirit to God, and we think of Jesus' prayer from the words from the cross in Luke 23:46, and Stephen echoes that prayer entrusting his spirit to God. And as Jesus does in Luke 23:34, Stephen issues a supplication or a prayer interceding for forgiveness on behalf of his executioners. So Stephen seems to, in a sense, imitate Jesus or models Jesus or reflects Jesus in the way he approaches his death as a martyr. In the early church, the martyrdom was often viewed as the highest charism or a gift, in a sense. It was actually viewed as a gift of the Spirit. Tertullian once said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And I'd heard that expression a number of times, but it's Tertullian is the one that expression is related to. This martyrdom was not without controversy, even in the early church. And in that time period, a man named Lucian, who was not a Christian, but he attributed the willingness of Christians to die for the faith to their arrogant belief in their own immortality. So how arrogant can you get to believe you're immortal? And that's what freed them up then to die these deaths, which were hard for people who were not part of the community of faith to understand. Now, in terms of defining martyr or martyrdom, martus is the Greek word, and in its basic meaning, it means witness. It means witness. You see a progression of development in terms of the meaning of this term, martus. First of all, it does refer, for example, in Acts 1 through 8, to witnesses of the events of Jesus' ministry. So that's the first basic meaning, this meaning of witness. A next step is that by their suffering, people had witnessed to Jesus. So their sufferings would be a witness to Jesus. And then finally, a third progression then is that some would be killed because of their faith in Jesus and the way they live their life, the way they proclaim Jesus in word and deed, they would be killed. There was a term, confessors, which is kind of a precursor to our understanding of martyrdom. And confessors were the faithful who were persecuted but survived. Okay? Persecuted but faithful who were persecuted but survived. And then the martyrs would be those who willingly suffer death. That's the ultimate price. The ultimate suffering then is to suffer death and rather than renounce their religion, rather than renounce their beliefs, they chose to suffer death. And just if you have any comments or questions during this part, just ask them at any point as I'm going along here. All right. So
my assumption is the martyr is kind of the tag is given by somebody that most of these true martyrs never intended to be martyrs. They were supporting what they were as far as they could, but they didn't. I assume they didn't look at themselves as martyrs as juxtaposed to some people in different parts of the world right now that are wanting to be martyrs. Is that a factor?
Well, I think you probably, my guess is we're dealing with a range. There would be some who, and there was some controversy because the way you approach it becomes an issue, does become an issue of whether you're a true martyr or not. And some probably viewed that as something they would seek it. But in terms of the church, there is a sense in which we look back now as a church, and even in the front of we have the Lutheran Book of Worship, the Green Book, and there's a calendar in there of special commemorations and so on of particular people, and some people are labeled martyrs and some are not. I mean, Bonhoeffer is not, for example. So there is a sense in which the church finally is the one who would apply that label to people, even though there were a lot that would obviously have martyrs in the early church that didn't make it into the calendar, so to speak. That's part of the controversy. Or what are the factors that lead to true
martyrs? I assume he never saw himself as a martyr. I'm just assuming that.
Who's it?
Bonhoeffer. Or maybe he did.
Well, let's see. Let's see where we end up on that. That'll be interesting. I don't know that he said, "I'm a martyr." That would have been too bold a statement. But he certainly was. We'll see what he has. I've got some stuff here that might be interesting to you on that.
Who makes the decision as to who is a martyr and who does not qualify?
Well, there are. I mean, the church has made some official declarations that this person is a martyr. But again, you're dealing with definitions, and it's fluid. And one of the reason you have to put a question mark in whether somebody like Bonhoeffer is a martyr or not, because it is controversial. Was he confessing the gospel and then publicly, and then he's put to death? Well, no, he wasn't confessing the gospel publicly in a clear way. So he becomes one where there would be some controversy about that. And in the early church, there was some controversy also. Oh, we tend to look back, and the classical martyr is the one who confesses Christ, and because of that public confession, is put to death for that.
And when you say the church, do you mean the ELCA?
No, I mean the church. I mean, I would never limit the church to the ELCA. But the ELCA does have its own calendar, where it has made some of these determinations. But the Catholic Church obviously has done a lot of this through the centuries of making these kinds of declarations. And they, of course, Catholic Church, it's quite a process to declare a saint, for example, in the Catholic Church. What are the criteria for determining Christian martyrdom? Okay, here's the classic criterion is a public confession of Jesus Christ results in condemnation to death, and then death. That's the classic criterion for determining Christian martyrdom. This Lisa Dayhill, the translator I mentioned of the volume, she fleshes out this classic definition and for us in a helpful way. And she has, it's three criteria, but the third one, the Imitatio Christi, she has four different parts of that. So let me go through this for you. The first one is a resistance to an evil state in the name of Jesus Christ leads to your arrest. So she's trying to apply some of this classic understanding, but look at, and she's setting it up to evaluate Bonhoeffer's involvement in the martyrdom. So this is what she's doing. The second one is confession of the name of Jesus Christ leads to a condemnation to death, which was that first, the first one I mentioned, the classic definition. So she's including that. And then she develops this notion of the imitatio Christi, the imitation of Christ in word and deed. And she says this involves four factors. One is a passive resistance to evil. A second is not seeking, yet freely accepting death if necessary. Okay, so this gets a little bit at what you were raising. So she understands this imitatio Christi. You're not seeking death, but you're freely accepting it if necessary. And thinking of Christ, Jesus, you know, he's even praised in the Garden of Gethsemane, this prayer, you know, remove this cup from me, yet not my will, but your will be done. So not seeking death, but willingly accepting it. Third part of this imitatio Christi, then, is manifesting patience, faith, and serenity in adversity up to the moment of death. Manifesting patience, faith, and serenity in adversity up to the moment of death. And then a fourth part of this is there's a confessional quality, is how she describes this, of total witness that draws others to Christ. So a confessional quality of total witness that draws others to Christ. So there's, it's their life, their writings, everything about who they are and how they carry out the mission they've been given and live out their lives. All of that somehow draws others to Christ.
Mark?
Yes.
The trouble I have with these definitions, I think, is that they fail to capture a large group of people the church has always recognized as martyrs. There's a new book about 3 years ago called Salvation at Stake. Very nice title, Salvation at Stake, because it's a history of martyrdom in early modern Europe. Now, this time, it's Christians putting Christians to death. It's Anabaptists being martyred by Protestants, Protestants being martyred by Catholics, and Catholics being martyred by Protestants. So none of these people were put to death simply or even mainly because they confessed Christ. I mean, confessing Christ was not a problem for any of these groups. All of them would have said that. It had to do then with, obviously, the notion that they were heretical in one way or another vis-a-vis the way they understood what it meant to be a Christian and so forth, and so that they were then put to death. So I guess the third list of criteria on the imitatio Christi, certainly the manner of their death, did conform to the kinds of things, by and large, that you were mentioning. And naturally, these different Christian bodies wouldn't have recognized each other's groups as being martyrs, but now the church kind of recognizes them all as martyrs. And I'm wondering where the third criteria you had there under imitatio Christi, are they developed to capture these people who were martyred by other Christians, or is that just a whole separate camp of people by this definition?
Well, good question. I'm going to give you one more set of criteria here, and I'm not sure that exactly gets at what you're talking about, but it may. Okay, so let's see where we end up on after that. I think this illustrates the point, though, is when you start trying to define who's a martyr and who's not, it's not easy to do, necessarily. There may be some that are just, we say, just classic, but it can get very complicated. Eberhard Bethge, Bonhoeffer's good friend, confessing partner, did write a book that was published in the 70s on Bonhoeffer, Exile, and Martyr. Okay, so that was a book he wrote that I came across. And he has a section in there where he defines martyrdom as testimony on behalf of threatened humanity. Testimony on behalf of threatened humanity. And he gives five different criteria there for martyrdom. And I'll share these five with you. And so we'll have several different sets here of criteria to deal with. Number one is it's freely chosen suffering. Freely chose, there's a voluntary element to this. You could have had it otherwise, but you freely choose to accept the suffering. The death happens at the hands of others. So this is suicide doesn't do it. And that's part of the, and we could argue in some ways, if you You know, Jesus could have walked out of Jerusalem. So did he commit suicide? Well, that's what we're trying. No, that's not suicide in the sense we want to say no. You know, it's, why did he stay? But people put him to death. He finally didn't kill himself in that sense. Number three is solidarity and guilt. Solidarity and guilt. And what he wants to get at here is you may not be viewed in the time in which you're killed as a holy martyr, even by your fellow Christians. In fact, the tendency in this kind of martyrdom where you're being martyred on behalf of threatened humanity, you may be a dishonored witness on behalf of humanity. So people are looking at you, yes, you may be trying to do this on behalf of humanity, but you're viewed with dishonor by many. And could be in society, but also in the church itself. It's not a clear witness at that point to others, or an honorable witness in the eyes of all. There's an authentic Christian character to this martyrdom. And humanity is the aim and truth of the message of Christ. That's the assumption here, that's what Christ is about. It's about human caring and love, God's love for human beings. And your witness then testifies to Christ and God's and Christ's love for human beings. And the final thing is your death is viewed as an authentic example and pattern, and it gives authority. Your death gives authority to your testimony for humanity. So the key move here is that he's arguing is that the actions of martyrs, and he's thinking of more contemporary martyrs, although it won't be limited to that, but he's certainly concerned about evaluating Bonhoeffer's example, is the real thrust is you're doing this not so much to confess Christ, although it grows out of a confession of Christ, but your death is a result of your love and concern for humanity, which you are, in a sense, carrying out God's love for humanity, and that ends up then in your death. How then, just given these criteria of martyrdom, how does Bonhoeffer stack up then? That's the question. And this is indeed a controversial issue. In June 19, 1932, Bonhoeffer did a sermon at the Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church in Berlin. Now, this is before Hitler's come to power, okay? Before he's involved in conspiracy, before he's even been threatened by the Nazis. So this is before all of that. It would be not too long after he's come back, about a year or so, or a little less than a year, since he's come back from the United States from his time at Union Seminary. And he had this to say in his sermon. "We must not be surprised if once again times return for our church." Let's see, I think I'm going to pause for a moment. He says, "We must not be surprised if once again times return for our church when the blood of the martyrs will be required. But even if we have the courage and faith to spill it, this blood will not be as innocent or as clear as the first martyrs. Much of our own guilt will lie in our blood, the guilt of the useless servant who is thrown into the darkness." So it's very striking to have. You know, I continue to be amazed by the things you see. This, you know, 26 years old, talking about this and looking at a situation that's not even happened yet in the most visible way in the country itself. Obviously, the Nazis had already been at work, and there were fears about Nazis coming to power. So I'm not saying there weren't any indications, but very much realizing that, and this is why I say, in a sense. You know, did he want to be a bar? Well, but he seems to have some sense that it may happen. You know, he doesn't say, "I'm going to be one of these people," but you have the sense that he's at least thinking that may be possible. Yeah. After the war, just to show you some of the controversy here, after the war was over, Lutheran Bishop Meiser refused to attend a memorial service for Bonhoeffer. And Meiser was... he was one of the radical Nazi supporters. He was one of the bishops, actually, that kept his regional church intact, and in a sense said, I'm not going all the way with the confessing church or with the so-called German Christian element. But Meiser refused to attend this memorial service for Bonhoeffer and Flossenbürg because he viewed him as a political martyr and not a martyr for the faith. So very laid it out that clearly. He's a political martyr. He was using willing to use the word political martyr, but not a martyr for the faith. A guy named Heinrich Fork, a leader in the confessing church during the Third Reich, so Luther or Bonhoeffer's church, stated in 1949, so 4 years after the war came to end, that true Christian martyrdom differs from the resistance movement, and that the point of departure lay not in politics, but only in the witness of the church. So again, making somewhat the same kind of point. In our Lutheran Book of Worship that I mentioned, for the, those who are evangelical Lutheran churches, our Lutheran Book of Worship lists Bonhoeffer on April 9th, which was the anniversary of his death, as a teacher of the church. A teacher of the church, not a martyr. There are some that would say, would even be willing to go so far, who involved with this, that in a sense he could even identify him as a confessor, even on the basis of the confession of the confessing church and so on, but he's identified as a teacher of the church, not a martyr. I've mentioned several times that he was executed for high treason and that charge was not removed in Germany until just a few years ago. That doesn't relate necessarily directly to his martyrdom, but I think it's just to show you the level of controversy within Germany about his role in that whole situation. In 1998, he was honored in Westminster Abbey as one of 10 outstanding Christian martyrs of the 20th century. So there's 10, they have these sculptures, I guess you'd call them, and I haven't been there, but if I get to London, I'm going to go visit Westminster Abbey and see this.
Do you know who the other 9 are?
Oh, there's some like Oscar Romero, Archbishop Romero. I don't know all 10. I've got a list somewhere. I believe Martin Luther King Jr. is one of the 10. Okay, that's in there if I remember right. Some that are maybe less recognizable unless you're really tracking this or are aware of a political situation in a given country and what happened there. So he's not the only one that would be controversial in terms of some of the classical definitions of martyrdom. The common quality for those that are honored in Westminster Abbey is that they were willing to stand firm in their faith against the perpetrators of violence and injustice in the world. So, you know, we haven't listed that as the criterion. I hadn't in these other, but that was the one that was the common quality. And then, so they viewed Bonhoeffer as one who stood firm in his faith against the perpetrators of violence and injustice in the world. Okay? So, well, how do we assess some of this then? And I'm just going to share some points about points of assessment and a couple of conclusions, and then we can talk about this. I think it's fair to say that he's not a martyr according to the classic definition. I just acknowledge that's true. He's not a martyr according to the classical definition. I would even suggest that it's a stretch. I'm not saying he couldn't do this, but I think it's a stretch at least to argue that Bonhoeffer was imitating Christ. And we may want to talk about that more. I think the case can be made that he acted on behalf of threatened humanity. That makes more sense, the criteria that Betke laid out for us in that point. I think that makes more sense to us. I would lift a caution that it's the attempt to affirm him as a martyr can easily become an effort to justify his actions or make a hero out of him. And I think there's a difference between being inspired by someone's life, their writings and their witness, being inspired by that, learning from that. But sometimes these efforts to label somebody a martyr or a saint or whatever can become an effort then to justify actions or to try to make a hero out of them. And I would even argue that sometimes when we, I don't want to get us off the track, but just to push this a little bit, even the way we talk about Jesus and relate to Jesus sometimes can be in a sense, excuse us from taking responsibility in our own time and place. So if we worship Jesus, lift up Jesus high, then it's like we've been Christian. And so it's a way, a subtle way in some ways, or maybe it's not so subtle, that by lifting up Jesus or lifting up Bonhoeffer or lifting up these people, it can, in a sense, relieve us of responsibility and mislead us into thinking that we've done what we need to do. I've suggested before, I think the charge of high treason ought to still stand against Bonhoeffer. He committed high treason, and I think that's just revisionist history to take that out of there. And I know it was people with the best intentions that probably worked to get that charge of high treason removed against him. I think it's a mistake. I think, if anything, in my mind, it weakens the story to remove that charge of high treason against him. Whether or not he qualifies as a Christian martyr, I do believe Bonhoeffer stands as an example of a Christian whose faith compelled him to take unprecedented risks. And so there's this, why it's inspirational and hopefully would inspire us if and when we're confronted with a situation, doesn't have to be that extreme even, but I would hope that his example would encourage us to take risks when necessary. And so I would agree, there's much to be inspired by and learn from. And some final qualifying comments or concluding remarks. I would question that we have to be very careful in this whole effort to identify martyrs. You know, what are we really up to when we get in the business of trying to identify martyrs, saints, whatever category it is we want to, of people we want to lift up? As I said, celebrating martyrs for the faith can be a way of avoiding taking risky action ourselves. Christian martyrs in our time may not be very readily identifiable. I don't think it's surprising. It's so hard to evaluate Bonhoeffer, and in a number of other cases, it's just not easy to recognize who a martyr would be by any set of criteria that we lift up. And I would say, finally, the whole question of martyrdom. And I would say that question finally needs to be left behind as we seek to discern what God's calling us to do in a given time and place. So I would really call into question if we got martyrdom on our mind when we're doing it, I think that could really skew us. I think we just need to focus on what God's calling us to do. And if that means martyrdom, so be it. But that becomes a consequence that we accept if necessary, but not the I think it can skew us if we get too involved in focusing on martyrdom in terms of what God's calling us to do. It might even just push us a whole other direction. We might even take risks that God's not calling us to take if we get too caught up in this sense of martyrdom. And so I'm saying this even as I know many others have been greatly inspired by the witness of the martyrs of the church, Bonhoeffer and many other people in our own time, by their courage and their faith. Comments and questions. Let's take some time to process this.
This is just a little bit on the other side of things, but in the history of Japan, Christians were tortured until they would reject Jesus. Mm. And so that there was a this writer writes about the apostasy of people, but when you think of how they were tortured, in a way, even though they gave up Jesus, terrible torture that I felt very sad for them, mm-hmm. sorry even. It was almost like they were martyred. For example, they would be hung upside down and left for a long period of time. Actually, if you don't let some blood out of your head every now and then, hung upside down, you die rather quickly. Mm-hmm. So what they would do, and I imagine yourself being hung upside down, they'd just cut their ears like that here, just a little tweak. So the blood would keep alive a long period of time, and you would just suffer horribly. And finally, the suffering is so bad, people would reject Jesus. And, you know, I mean, under what conditions is that a martyr, or is it called an apostasy?
Could you read Bethke's fifth criteria?
Yes. The death gives authority to your testimony for humanity. You know, I also had And it's, I've got the phrase, he uses it, death as an authentic example and pattern gives authority to the testimony for humanity. It's that one, it's confusing the way he worded that one.
Well,
but the point is your death, it's kind of like, he's trying to pick up on the notion that the prophet's death gave authority to the word he proclaimed. I think this is Betke's variation on that.
Well, maybe I'm not getting it at all, but it seems to me there's a tinge of mythology or a tinge of publicity that comes with that, that criteria, that a person who dies for their faith and no one ever knows about it. I mean, say a missionary who's on his way to the heathens and his ship sinks and he dies. We don't call those people martyrs.
No.
That there has to be some carryover.
A public recognition.
Yeah, that it affects people or inspires people somehow. And feeds the cause. Actually has a positive consequence related to the cause they were espousing.
Those are not the people that Tertullian had in mind, though, right? I mean, Tertullian had in mind just the people who would be, you know, ordinary folks who were Christians, who when they confronted them, the pagan emperor and his minions, and said, ask them to confess Jesus as Lord, would say yes, they did, and they would get an instant spear.
Yeah.
Those people were not subjected, you know, widely publicized or largely influential within their communities. But so originally the term, when it arises in a pagan environment. I think this is important because it changes the whole problem once you get Christian, quote unquote, emperors or countries or the Holy Roman Emperor in early modern Europe. But in Rome, it was clearly a pagan situation over and against Christians who merely had to confess Jesus as Lord, and that was it. And many of them, most of them, are anonymous. But they would still be called, by Tertullian and others, martyrs in that sense.
Yeah.
So the publicity, I think, what you're pointing to, comes rather more late in the kind of common usage of the term martyr, that we expect that the person will be of heroic and widely publicized standing. Or initially they were anonymous, for the most part.
I'm kind of struck with our need to have these classifications, and sometimes by making them so narrow, we do disservice to the people that don't quite make sainthood or don't quite make, and are probably more important than those that are. And I'm struck, I've done some reading on the use of the word genocide, and the fact that there are people that are so protective of genocide, basically meaning only what happened in the Holocaust in Germany, that politically they don't want to use that word if we're in Africa or for other parts of the country where there's slaughtering going on, because it means that we're going to have to do something about it. So by protecting that word, making it almost so, in the past, and so unattainable, I guess I'm just wondering if we do a disservice to even be too awfully concerned about whether it's a person who meets that goal, or I was struck by the name of some of the names that you were listing about in Westminster Abbey. I don't think several of those, I don't think, would make it under classic definition, at least as I understood it. But those are great people that should be honored and should be recognized and should teach us a lesson, but somehow if they can't make it, we kind of say, well, they're not there yet, so we don't have to.
Well, I mean, I think finally it is the way we approach this question. Does it end up serving the faith or not?
Yeah.
You know, does it end up being a witness to the faith or?
Or blind.
Yeah, that's so. How we approach this becomes an important question. I would say putting people in Westminster Abbey certainly may inspire many people. So that's not a bad thing in and of itself. But how we approach that, and then how we respond, finally, this comes down to not just who's a martyr, who's not, but how do the way we study lives, writings, whatever, and their whole witness, how does that impact on us, both as individuals and as part of a community of faith?
I know you mentioned that the charge of high treason was dropped, but how is Bonhoeffer viewed in Germany today, and is he widely known?
Good question. I mean, very controversial for many years within the, not just in Germany, but even in the church circles of the people that are regularly participating in the church, very controversial. I think there's a bit of a renaissance going on. I mean, there's all, there have been people appreciated Bonhoeffer a long way, so I don't want to give you the wrong impression. But in fact, probably appreciated and utilized in some ways even more in Eastern Germany for years than in Western Germany. But now I think there is a, I detect, and I'm, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time in Germany, but I detect a desire to look back at this chapter of history for Germans and to look for people that were German that were courageous, had integrity, and so on. So, for example, when the movie Agent of Grace about Bonhoeffer came out, not the documentary we showed here, but there was a new movie called Agent of Grace, and it was shown in Germany when I was over there and we had the International Bonhoeffer Congress in Berlin in year 2000. The premiere was in Berlin during that Congress. And maybe somebody planned it or it just worked out that way. The review in the German papers after it was premiered, the one review that I read, extremely positive about this. And the actor who so many of the Bonhoeffer scholars from this country were critical of this actor. He just is, that's not Bonhoeffer, that's not the Bonhoeffer we knew. The review thought he did a wonderful job in that role as Bonhoeffer. And now that's one review, but I just sense there's an eagerness, and even if some of you may have seen the Luther film that just came out, Luther movie that came out, maybe you just got to see it. Maybe you did, because not a lot of people flocked to the movie theaters to see this, but this was kind of our effort to have something that the public would watch. Not real well received, and certainly people weren't flocking. In fact, I went to a theater on a Monday afternoon in Puyallup, and I had a private viewing. I was where do you sit for a year? You're the only one there, and they showed the movie, and I watched it. But this was Luther. The Luther movie went to Germany, and there was a time when it was the fourth highest rated movie in all of Germany. I mean, of all movies. It's a box office hit. And again, what they were picking up, Luther's very controversial because of some of the comments he made about the Jews and so on, but they also saw him as someone, you know, acting on principle and conscience, you know, and really some integrity in his witness. So I sense there's a little more openness and people looking to Bonhoeffer and within the churches, and this new 16-volume set is out now, and so all this is part of the mix there in Germany right now.
Yeah, back in 1975, there was a conference in Bavaria that my dad went to, and Eberhard Bethge was there, and they were discussing Dietrich Bonhoeffer.
So. Yeah. So he's been around, had influence, but I would say even now, maybe, I think he'll continue. He's strong.
Your comments about East Germany reminded me of a time in the late 60s, I think this is recently in our history, when the Lutheran, the Executive Committee of the Lutheran World Federation met in East Germany. And we had taken our son David, who was here this week and last week, and our oldest son Paul, to go with us into East Germany, and they were not permitted in because they were Christians. And they did not want the young people in East Germany to have any idea that there were Christian young people in the other part of the world. But the point of my story is the young people in East Germany were giving up their college educations to profess Christianity. And they were the stewards at the point we met and waited on table and clean rooms and that sort of thing. And I remember sitting at the steps of one of the dorms before we left, talking to a young woman who had been there and knew that she would never go to college because she participated in this Lutheran and Christian activity. And I said, you must come visit me, you know how you do. And she said, when I'm over 60 and of no use to the state, then maybe. But she knew what she had done, and she was willing to pay that price. Huh. And I think we don't realize that for that reason in history, there have been people who have suffered, given up, for their faith.
Well, you can see where in East Germany, the reason Bonhoeffer might have been especially helpful there is, especially like his prison writings and that, he's dealing with a totalitarian government, and you end up with another totalitarian government, and so there's much of what he said, and even encouraging, what does the church do when you're in a minority situation? You may, all you can do is suffer under wrong, which is in effect what you're saying these young people are having to do, is there was only so much they could do to actually fight the that situation. Dean, and then we'll go over here. Go ahead, Dean.
My comments are a little like a guy who tells a joke and then it comes to the punchline and he can't remember it, but I'll make a stab at it. About 55 years ago, right after World War II, there was a movie that came out, and I don't know whether it was based on a book or not, but the title of it was Question 7. And it kind of haunted me because it referred to the pastors, and I think, of course, it'd be Lutheran pastors, that were confronted with a series of questions, and question seven had to do with, and here's the punchline, it had to do with, I think, whether your allegiance is to Christ or to the Nazis. And they had to answer that question. And the pastors had to wrestle with this. And if they said, yes, my allegiance is to Christ, they were out of there and in jail. If they told a lie and said, no, my allegiance is to the Nazis, they were allowed to be okay, but then they could sneak around and take care of their flock. And that was a terrible decision that they had to make. And I don't know how they would fit into the definition of martyrs, but I know that that question has haunted me for a long time.
Boy, question seven, right here and then back.
I was just thinking of two things. One was when I was in college at Concordia Teachers College, and way back in the early 60s, had a professor, we were studying Romans, and he very adamantly said that Bonhoeffer was totally wrong because according to Romans, he should have supported his government. And all the students were, of course, horrified because we were all busy reading Bonhoeffer. But that was one thing. The other one you reminded me is Dag Hammarskjöld, whatever his name was, years ago wrote this book, Silence, which was about, was it a priest, I think? It's been so long since I read it. In China, I think it was, who had to choose between denying Christ and having his congregation live, or standing up for Christ, and he would die, and his congregation would die. And he chose to deny Christ. And so the whole question in the book is, like you said, he ended up denying Christ, and because he knew that then the church would live. So. Yeah,
boy, that's a question.
So the just to help a little bit with that narrative, the book is Susiko Endo, E-N-D-O actually, wrote the book, and it's about martyrdom in Japan.
Okay, the wrong country.
And so you're very close to the right. But I'm just mentioning this just in case people want to read that book. It's a powerful book, and it does present this question. The way in which the person was asked to deny Christ was to walk literally over the face of Christ in the, I would say how the book ends. It's a powerful novel based on what Christians in Japan were subjected to, which I think you were alluding to earlier with your comments. And I think that it's relevant in a number of ways. It suggests that where you really have martyrdom going on in the world now, or in the 19th or 18th or 17th centuries, which was much like the early Christian martyrdom, is under regimes that are like the Soviet regime and so forth, utterly pagan and hostile to either religion in general or Christianity in particular. I mean, you can think of the Christians in the Sudan being martyred now, some of them, by Islamic forces, for example. So there again, it's specifically because they are Christians and professing Christ, as it was in the case of 19th century Japan, as was in the case under the Soviet regime, and so forth and so on. And I think there's something about that particular use of the term martyrdom in that narrower sense that is compelling to me for this reason, and this would exclude Bonhoeffer. What I think is at stake here is that Bonhoeffer's witness comes out of the fact that his bearing witness is not professing Christ, it's living the Christian life in the way that he's compelled to live it. All right. And all of us in this room right now, I think, without exception, agree that he lived it in a way that we admire. Okay? So we don't have any problem calling him a martyr. Now, what about somebody who is compelled by their faith to physically block a clinic that performs abortions? Okay? There's no question they're a Christian. There's no question they profess Christ. And there's absolutely no question that they see that as forced upon them as being a Christian, to stop that kind of murder. Okay?
Or shoots the doctor.
Well, let's just leave that too tricky there. I'm just going to assume now that in blocking the clinic, they are then killed by something. Okay? Now, are they a martyr? Now, regardless of how you answer that question, all the examples meant to do is to show how then you begin to argue over whether what the person did, really, indisputably it emerged from their Christian faith, was really admirable, and this gets politically divisive, and this is why the whole issue becomes an issue, whether you want to call that person a martyr. I mean, I'm disposed to want to call Bonhoeffer a martyr because I admire what he did, and I don't deny it came from his Christian faith, but I think that's much harder for the counterexample, or the different example, I should say, that I just gave, than to just say someone who's facing the spear of the Roman emperor and confesses Jesus as Lord, and they're killed for it. I mean, that seems to be a much cleaner example.
The clarity of the witness is clear.
That's right.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Last comment here, and then we'll just take a few minutes just quickly to get some insights.
My question, I think, is related to what you said, and that is, if I understood your comments correctly, you disqualify Bonhoeffer from being a martyr because he was charged with and convicted of high treason?
Oh, I'm not necessarily disqualifying him. My biggest concern is about how we approach the question of martyrdom itself. Because, and just for some of the reasons, even because of how tricky this gets to look at some of these examples that you've given, even this example, according to Bonhoeffer's ethics, you might be called to deny Christ if you're going to save a whole, and bring that shame upon yourself in order to save a village or a community of faith. And that's why, so I'm more concerned about that. But many have questioned whether Bonhoeffer should be considered a martyr because it was political.
Was he given political process or a legal process before his conviction?
There was a hearing and so on, and there was a legal process that he went through before he was convicted, yes. Although the final order to kill him was given by Hitler at the end, which, you know, then Führer becomes law. But there was a political process that he went through, and it's, some of those documents are in our volume, so I am familiar with it. But he was indicted, his brother-in-law was indicted, and so on. Let me just we've got just a few minutes here. Insight, something you've learned, what stood out to you from anything you've heard today or through the week, something about Bonhoeffer's witness, something you're still concerned about, you wonder about with him, or don't agree with that's been presented. What kinds of things stand out? So just, and we'll just go around whoever wants to offer something. Any comments?
I don't have a question about it, but I admire him so much for being one of the people who strove to fight this problem against humanity from within Germany, from within the country itself.
Yeah.
I don't know how many people, you know, really could do that successfully.
Yeah, or even try. You know, in some ways he failed, but he definitely tried.
Well, what strikes me is the theme of this week, vocation, of the vocation he selected given the privilege status.
Mm-hmm. Okay, huh.
Yeah.
So he could have ridden this out.
What strikes me is we are speaking of definitions, martyrdom, etc., and these examples of those who gave their lives so the congregation could live and so on. We are talking about what people judge. And I think the important thing is, hey, it doesn't matter if this man denied his Christianity to save his congregation. The real judge is, what is God saying about this? And in a way, this is a bunch of semantics that is really irrelevant in the big picture, which is God is judging what you were doing.
And just quickly, Bonhoeffer would say, yes, God is the ultimate judge, and so our job is to discern what God's calling us to do in this time and place, and then to leave that final judgment or ultimate judgment to God. That's very much in line with this thinking there.
I was struck again how what it comes down to is something very simple, which is living for each other.
Right.
Which can be so simple and can be so complex.
Yeah. And you know, we haven't been able to cover all of his writings, but that basic point's made in his dissertation, in a sense, takes on life, is what the way I phrase it. People like to see, is there discontinuity or continuity for Bonhoeffer? And say there's continuity, but it gets enfleshed in different ways because of the circumstances that he's involved in and the church is involved in Germany as a nation. Others?
The thing that I've enjoyed is to learn more, because I've studied him in the past, and he got beyond me a little bit in the right. What attracts me to him is that he had a lot of characteristics that I probably wouldn't like if I were to meet him. I mean, he's privileged, rich, incredibly intelligent, and probably uses his position. Writes a doctoral thesis of whatever age he was, 21. He's too young to really know anything, and he's already going pontificating and doing all this stuff. And then he goes and he gets involved early on and becomes very political, and he ends up trying to kill somebody. And I get all of these things that in my head I have to say are, I don't agree with that, but at the same time, that to me makes him more real. He's not just this, I think we tend to make these martyrs saints, and the fact that he maybe not fit the classic martyr mold makes him more real to me, and makes him figure that he was probably struggling a lot, done it, and probably made some mistakes, and probably was arrogant or rich or whatever, but it makes him more real, and I find that more, real, more helpful, that he is more relevant than just this saint that he put up on a placard.
What attracted you to Bonhoeffer, and what caught you? What were you caught by to have
good
this
question?
Well,
I read Cost of Discipleship and Letters and Papers from Prison in a class at Pacific Lutheran University, and I was at a point where I had not left the church behind, but I had a lot of questions that I was asking, and all of a sudden, the way he was wrestling with things, both theoretical, practical, the pastoral work, academic work, although I wasn't planning to be a pastor at that point, but I found it very helpful the way he was addressing some of the issues that I was struggling with, and especially in terms of the life of the church and what it means to live out the faith and that, and the fact that he was actually wrestling with these questions. And then I think the other key insight, and I shared it yesterday, that really grabbed me in reading this was this whole notion of disworldliness, and to get our focus on, here was somebody who affirmed God's love for the world, rather than the sense of that we're here, we go about our lives, we should take care of people, but finally what it's all about is the life after this, so that this life is almost discounted in some way. And that's what in much of my childhood, I'm not saying my dad was trying to teach me this, but somehow that's what I was picking up along the way, that, finally when push came to shove, what counted was to believe in Jesus so you get to heaven. And here was somebody who was coming at things in a different way. Not denying the life to come, that's not the point. But your focus while you're here, your calling in terms of vocation, your calling is here. What's life to come is something, that's not your vocation in a sense, isn't the life to come. That's something that comes down the line. It's after death. It's not something that we focus on here now. Let's see, a couple more comments and then we need to be done. Does anybody have anything else? Dean.
Oh, it just makes me wonder if I would have the courage to do what he did, or would I chicken out? I would hope the former, but I don't know. I guess I wouldn't know until I were tested.
And take quite a bit of nerve to do some of the stuff that you, when you get involved in that. And that's where, you know, some of us might want to it or have the will, but whether we have even the nerve and the capabilities to do it, you know, finally we don't know till we get there. Here and here.
I guess kind of related to that, it's so easy in retrospect to see Bonhoeffer's time as an extraordinary situation and him as making the right or the courageous decision. But to think at the time, having to say, is this an extraordinary situation yet? And am I doing the right thing? And you know, the uncertainty that he faced, and kind of, you know, thinking about it, not in hindsight, but at the time, for me, that's very powerful.
Yeah, because you're finding your way. It's not just laid out for you.
After listening to all these things about Bonhoeffer's life, I'd like to know what your opinion is on our support of a figure like Archbishop Romero, for example, and what he was doing at the time. Is there a justification from our faith that we should support a person like he, who was deeply religious but also deeply political, working against a repressive regime?
Well, I do see why Bonhoeffer, Martin Luther King Jr., Archbishop Romero, these are people that I look at it as living out their faith, and it's not even ours to. I mean, we do have to make some judgments ourselves, because if you're involved in a situation, you know, you may have to be making judgments about whether you support what this person's doing or not. But I certainly see him as being another example of somebody who was willing to, you know, take on the powers. Romero, in a way, he was shot while he's serving communion. So that, in some sense, you could probably make a stronger argument that that's closer to the classical definition. But in terms of Romero, what's striking to me with Romero is the way he gave up a position of privilege, in a sense, and then began to look at things from below, so to speak. And so that's the connection I would draw most closely with Bonhoeffer, is someone who could have remained in a position of privilege, but began to look at things from a different point of view, and it affected then how he ended up, the actions he took, and the way he related to people who were in need. We're going to make this the last comment here. You have the last word.
Well, I was just going to comment on the question you just asked. Bishop Medardo Gomez was a countryman of Archbishop Romero, and Medardo Gomez, as many of you know, is a very influential Lutheran pastor in Latin America, and there are a number of Lutheran pastors in Latin America who either knew him or were taught the catechism by him and received their first communions from him, and it would be beneficial to have him come and talk sometime. You could ask that very question to him sometime.
I'm also glad that all our leaders that have that kind of courage don't get killed, because we do need them. And so, yes, it's a powerful witness, and Bonhoeffer's death, I think, does authenticate that, Romero and Martin Luther King Jr. and so on. But there is clearly a loss also in terms of leadership of the communities that they're leading when they are killed. And I mean, it's the powers that be know who to go after too. They're not stupid about these kinds of things. And they go after key people trying to stop what they see as movements that going against their desires. Well, thank you. Enjoy the week.